Good morning. So, last time we finished discussing AT&T syntax, or the assembly syntax we're going to use this semester, which is unlike what you may or may not remember from 2150, where we had the destination last, where we marked all constants with a dollar sign. If there wasn't a dollar sign, we had a number that wasn't a constant. It was part of a memory location using this general form. We had a displacement, a base, an index, and a scale, and we could omit all sorts of parts of that. And were all the registers, we had a percent sign to indicate them. If there was no percent sign, instead we had a label. We also talked a bit about labels, which you've seen before, but you know, maybe didn't internalize sort of what actually they mean in assembly. And we thought of labels as, well, we had a place where we declared what the label pointed to, and they got replaced by the address of the thing labeled. So sometime in between our assembly file, when the executable is produced, it's going to be made as if we typed in the actual memory address that thing label had. We also talked about LEA, instruction you probably saw in 2150, but that's a big source of confusion. And the LEA instruction computes an address specified using our usual way of specifying locations in memory and places the address in the destination, not the thing in memory there. The name of LEA comes from this concept of an effective address, and an effective address is just the memory address used by an instruction for data. So in the case of a move instruction, it's the address, if it's a move to or from memory, that we access memory to move into or out of. But in LEA, it's the actual address we load into the destination register. We also briefly talked about the special pseudo register RIP, which is the program counter, which you can't actually like write to with a move instruction, but you'll often see used to compute addresses for move in LEA in assembly code. And also had this really special case with this label RIP syntax if you're looking at assembly output from a compiler. So questions about these things we covered last time? Yes?
Can you
go over label RIP? So label RIP, this is the same as label in assembly. But with different machine code. That makes sense? And I guess, sure, so, and the machine code's different in that when the processor runs it, it's going to turn into some offset from RIP, some offset from the current instruction, rather than a constant address. Which matters if we copy the machine code to other locations in memory. Other questions, follow-ups? Yes. Sorry? So RIP represents the program counter. So it contains the address of the following instruction. And it's not like a normal register. You like can't move into RIP. That's just not an instruction that exists. Yes?
What do you mean by address of the following instruction? Because in the following instruction, is the next line in the assembly code?
Question, what I mean by the address of the following instruction, is that the next line in the assembly code? Yes. Or even if there's no next line, whatever memory location's after the current instruction. Other questions? Okay. So, we'll do a final few concepts in assembly. So we're going to start with one thing which should be reviewed, but is worth reviewing because, especially for the bomb assignment, it comes up a bunch. And that's the calling convention. So if you hopefully remember from 2150, we have a way we call functions, and this is called a convention because, well, the processor, for the most part, doesn't actually implement anything which says you have to put arguments to functions in any particular place. Like, this is a choice that was made by compiler writers and operating system writers about where to put these things. And on 64-bit x86 Linux, these are the choices that were made for, well, most of the arguments we're going to care about and return values we're going to care about in this class. And they just said, okay, we have to have arguments somewhere. Let's use these six registers. And, well, we could just keep reserving more registers for arguments, but we're going to run out eventually. So eventually we need a backup. Our backup solution is that they go on the stack. In particular, they're pushed onto the stack before the return address is. And we also need to say, where does the return value go? And they just said, okay, we'll choose REX for that. I don't expect you to memorize this. There's a figure in the book. We have a written final where you need to know it. We'll tell you. But this is the convention, and this is how you would read assembly code that calls a function. That hopefully we're following this convention. Like, there's no actual requirement. If we decide to put the first argument in R10, and our code that calls the function does that, and our function does that, well, there's not going to be a problem. But if we're following this convention and working with all the other code on our system, it's going to be an RDI, and so on. So questions about this calling function? Yes. So is this the same as the C calling convention? Yes. So this is for C code on x86-64 Linux. So I'm being specific about it being 64-bit x86 in Linux because you might see slightly different calling conventions on other 64-bit x86 systems for C, even. And also, on Linux, this is typically essentially the calling convention used for languages that aren't C. Not always, but typically. Other questions? Okay. So this means that if you're looking at some assembly and you see a call instruction, so a call instruction pushes the return address, and the return address is the address of the next instruction where we want to go to, so that's right here. That's the same thing that would be the value of RIP I discussed earlier, onto the stack, and then jumps to the location specified. And you see these moves being done beforehand. Well, they're probably being done beforehand because these are the arguments. And per our calling convention, our arguments are 1, 2, and 3. And in this case, we have a return value, which we put in EAX by just putting it there before we return. Return pops what call pushes, and so ends up jumping to this arrow. Questions? Yes. So the question is, why is it move L? So it's move L is a 4-byte move, and because we're moving into EDI, ESI, EDX, it has to be move L and not move Q or something like that. Other questions? Yes. So the next instruction isn't foo? Yeah, so by next instruction, I mean the one that's after the call in memory, which presumably this dot, dot, dot means there's something that's not the foo. Other questions? So the question is, what happens to the program counter during this? So the call instruction, I guess, it computes the address of the next instruction, but before the call instruction finishes, it sets the program counter to point to foo. To be foo, I should say. The program counter is a pointer. We'll learn that the actual details of how the processor tracks what it calls the program counter varies depending on exactly how you implement the processor. So exactly whether internally the processor would really be looking at the next instruction or foo at what point in time, it depends on the implementation choices. Other questions? Yes. Sorry? So you said return the location of the first instruction? What will return? Yeah, so the next instruction, I mean the instruction that this arrow would point to, the one that would be here in assembly. So the one you want to run after the call finishes. And by finishes, I mean, so after the whole function call, including everything the function does, finishes. Other questions? Yes. Pushes that onto the stack, yes. So if our stack pointer points here before the call, after the, we'll have the return address. This will be pushed, this will be the stack pointer after the call, and then after the return, it will point back there, point back where it was before. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned what call and return do. So another part of our calling convention is we need to decide what happens to registers when I call a function. If I have this call foo, can I assume that a register I'm keeping some temporary variable in, you know, let's say I have a loop for I is 1 to 100, can I keep I in a register and call a function in that loop? Well, we have to decide what functions are responsible for doing. And x86-64 Linux made the choice that these registers, functions can't change. Well, they can't make them have a different value when they return. They can change them, but they have to restore the original value later. And this means that, for example, I can put I in R12 in my loop, and that's going to be fine, because even though I'm calling a function, if the function wants to use R12, it needs to save the old value and restore it before it returns, or else it is not following the rules we set out for it. And again, this is a list that you don't need to memorize, you can look it up. Yes? So is your question, what ret pops have to do with EAX? So nothing. So I'm going to try to be very careful in my terminology. The return address is the code we want to run after a function returns. The return value is the data the function is giving back to whoever called it. And ret pops from the stack the return address. It does nothing with the return value. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. So the typical pattern when we have this rule about what functions we need to save is that if you have a function that uses, say, R12, one of these call these saved registers, that you'll save it somewhere. The most obvious location to save it is the stack, which you can do in x86-64 by pushing and then popping later on to restore the old value. So it's push saves the value, pop restores the old value, so whoever called us doesn't know that R12 changed. As far as they're concerned, they had, you know, the value of I when it began, and when it returned, it still had the same value of I. Nothing was amiss. Now, let's say for our loop counter, we wanted to use R11. Well, R11 wasn't on that list of callee saved registers, so it's what's known as caller saved, meaning that if I'm the caller of a function, and I care about that register having the same value after I finish the call, I need to do the logic for that. So in this example, I've chosen to push R11 to the stack, then call foo, which may or may not change R11. We don't know. But we want to work with any version of foo, so we can't make assumptions about that. And then after foo returns, we're going to restore the old value of R11. So for example, we still have our loop counter I. That's what we're putting in R11. So questions about these patterns? Yes?
Why do you have to declare quad for the call?
Why do I have call Q here and call elsewhere? It doesn't actually matter. Technically, call has a size that it's dealing with. So if you look at disassembly, you'll typically see call Q. But since on 64-bit x86, it's always call Q, you can write call. Yes?
If you had a chain of three functions, would the second function be called callee or caller or save?
The question is, if I had a function calling a function calling a function, what do I use for the names caller and callee? So when we're talking about caller or callee saved, we're always talking about just one particular function call that we care about. And we do have these nested cases, but the way that's going to work is that we're going to say that for each call, someone's responsible for saving or not individually. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes?
So because nothing was called into, that means it's just saved, then R12 is a callee saved register.
You say because nothing is called in foo? So foo could have function calls. So it could call some function bar. And that wouldn't change anything about what it has to do with R12, because if bar wants to change R12, bar needs to do the same thing foo's doing for that call. Does that answer your question?
So it basically just has to be used for it to be defined as a caller and callee.
So the question is, does something have to be used to be defined as caller or callee saved? So we say the registers are always caller or callee saved. And if it's callee saved, if you're the callee, you're the function who's called, you're responsible for making sure the value doesn't change. Now, if you don't actually use the register, you can fulfill that responsibility by doing nothing. But if you're using the register, you need to do extra work like here. Does that answer your question? Yes. So question is, what should you put where, right? And how should you choose? So generally, compilers try to figure this out. And if we think about functions that don't call other functions, then you probably want to use caller safe stuff, right? Because that's less work. If we have functions which call other functions, if you have functions which call other functions, you probably would prefer to use callee saved stuff, so it's less work for you, and it's possible the functions you're calling don't actually use those registers. A lot of functions don't use R12, so maybe if you use R12, and you call other functions, that will be just less stuff being saved overall. So that's probably the heuristics you'd use. But if you have a function that calls other functions, like, it's not clear which is better to choose. Other questions? Yes. So question is, can I do push instead of push Q here? And yes. In fact, on 64-bit x86, there is no 32-bit version of push, or 16-bit version of push. Other questions? OK. So there's some things about assembly that you might see if you're looking at, say, probably not the bomb, but other things, some of which we'll cover later in the semester. So there's some registers, XMM0 through XMM15, and also YMM0 through YMM15, that have to do with floating point and vector operations. And the calling convention for floating point is something I didn't discuss, but it's different because you can't, we're not supposed to store floating point values in RAX or, and so on. There's something called segmentation. We have, in the bomb lab, you might see this FS. There's a note specifically about that at the bottom of the bomb lab. But we're basically not going to talk about it because it's a feature that x86 has that basically no one else does. And is not used for its intended purpose in x86 either. And also, x86 64 has tons of instructions that you can look up if you need to know of them. We're not going to like try to go thoroughly over all the instructions in x86 64. Now, there is one remaining assembly topic I want to go over, which is something which is theoretically review, but we're going to talk about some details which I think don't get talked about in 2150. And this is going to be about how conditionals work in x86 assembly. But before we move on to that, questions about these sort of just things we're skipping mostly? Okay. So as you may or may not remember from 2150, if we think of this pseudocode, if RAX doesn't equal 0, call foo. So a way we could write that is we can use a compare instruction to compare 0 and RAX. If they're equal, then we don't call foo. Otherwise, we run our call foo instruction. And something that I think is usually glossed over in 2150 that's going to be important if we want to think about how do we make a processor is how does the JE instruction, the jump if equal instruction, know the result of that comparison? But information has to be put somewhere, so where is it put? And a more semantic question of what happens if I put instructions in between the compare and the jump equal? Is that going to make, is the code still going to quote unquote work? So we're going to talk about both of those. And we're going to talk about this by talking about the place where x86 stores the result of that comparison. And these are some special registers called the condition codes. And you'll say, okay, so they're set by comparisons. But that's not what I have written on the slide. They're set by almost all arithmetic instructions. And you might say, wait a moment. But if they're like set by a multiply, what does it mean to multiply and then jump if equal? Like, how does the multiply equal? How does that work? And you might say, okay, so they store info about the operands to the instruction. No. They store info about the result of that arithmetic operation. And we'll talk about how that makes sense with compare later. So they store information like, was the result of the last arithmetic operation zero? Was it negative, etc.? So you might say, wait a moment. This information I listed, equal isn't part of that. So what is jump equal? Or jump greater than? So jump greater than, jump less than, all these instructions, they read the condition codes, and they're named based on interpreting the result of subtraction, which you can think of as being the same as comparing a result to zero. So if we subtract two values that are equal, we get zero. So you can think of jump equal as checking for, did we get a zero result? If we subtract a greater value from a lesser value, we get a positive result. So you can think of jump greater as checking whether a result is greater than zero. And the opposite for jump less than. So that's all the naming of these is based on, you know, either you can think of it as comparing to zero or a subtraction. And that's sort of what they're looking for. And that's how you figure out what they would do if we did something other than a subtraction, in which case their names might not make much sense. So I gave the high-level view, but let's talk about exactly what information is going to be stored. So x86 has chosen a particular set of bits of information to store about the arithmetic result. They don't just store the result. They store the summary of the result. And we're going to talk about the individual bits of that, which they call flags. So one of these flags is the zero flag, also called ZF. So it's, was the result zero? So for subtract, the result zero, the two values were equal. And jump if equal checks for the zero flag being one. And jump if not equal checks for it being zero. There's also the sign flag, which is, was the result negative? And the reason for this name is, if you remember 2's complement, when we had a negative number, the sign bit was set. So this sign flag means that when we do arithmetic, we just copy the sign bit into this special SF register. Now, this seems like enough to do all our comparisons. Greater than, less than, and so on. And it is, except we're not handling a very important detail, well, kind of very important, which is overflow. Now, we're going to have some assignments where you build a little processor simulator, as we mentioned earlier. And to keep things simpler, we're just going to handle overflow incorrectly. We're just going to ignore overflow, and we're going to use these two flags and say, if there's overflow, your comparison gives the wrong result. But for a real processor, that isn't acceptable. So we're going to briefly mention what the extra information we're going to track for that. Yes?
So if the result wasn't zero, would the zero flag equal zero?
So the question, if the result wasn't zero, the zero flag will be zero? Yes. Yes?
What happens to the sign flag if you're doing unsigned arithmetic?
The question is, what happens to the sign flag if you're doing unsigned arithmetic? So, if you remember most of the instructions you probably know, like add, subtract, and so on, most of them don't have a way for you to say, am I doing signed or unsigned arithmetic? So the processor doesn't know. So the sign flag is going to be set based on the sign bit, where it would be for 2's complement, regardless, because the processor has no way of knowing it's really unsigned. So you might say, how do I do an unsigned comparison then? And that's going to have to do with how overflow is handled. So I'll get to that in a sec, but your question?
And then after, like, say, JE checks the zero flag, would the zero flag get reset?
So the question is, does something like JE, after it checks the zero flag, reset it? No. These flags are set by the arithmetic operations, they aren't reset unless you do it explicitly. Yes?
If the
Question, is there a difference between sub and compare? Yes. As we'll mention again later, the difference is that compare doesn't write to a destination register. Yes? Question, is the sign flag changed to 1 if the result is 0? No. It's negative, not non-positive. Yes, the or is important here, yes, for JLE because of that. Right. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned we have to handle overflow in a real processor, so we're not going to do that for our assignments. And also, someone mentioned the issue of what about unsigned values? What about comparing unsigned values? And if we think of like doing a subtraction for unsigned values for less than, like, that would be an overflow case, right? If we would get a negative number, that's an overflow of an unsigned value. And there are two flags that x86 tracks to deal with overflow, one called OF, the overflow flag, and one called CF, the carry flag. And the overflow flag is if we imagine the computation was a signed computation, did it overflow? And the carry flag is if we imagine this computation was an unsigned computation, did it overflow? And this is why when you're reading x86 64 assembly, you'll see signed jump operators, JLE and so on, do deal with signed comparisons, and unsigned ones like JB, jump if below, and so on. That's the difference between them, is which of these overflow-related flags they use, whether they use the overflow flag if they're signed operations or the carry flag if they're unsigned. And I guess and since the signed flag doesn't make sense for the unsigned one, so they're just using the overflow information, not the signed flag, for the unsigned jump types. So I'm just going to mention basically that these exist. We're not going to actually deal with implementing them or working through them, but I want you to know about that so when you're reading assembly and you see jump below, you know what's going on. Yes? The question is, where are these flags stored? So these are extra registers in the processor. They're stored probably in a similar location to like RAX. And if you look in GDB and type info registers, you might see this E flag pseudo register. And that includes these flags and a few flags we won't talk about. And so, for example, this output says something called PF, ZF, and IF are set. And all the other ones are clear. So this tells you that the zero flag is set, the sign flag, the overflow flag, and the carry flag are zero. And also PF, which is parity flag if you look it up, and IF, which is the interrupt flag if you look it up, are both set. Yes, question?
Could you explain one more time how you interpreted that ZF was set to 0?
Question, how did I interpret ZF was set to 0? So ZF is set to 1 here.
How did you figure that out?
Because it's, and I figured that out, and the question, how did I figure that out? I figured that out because in GDB's output here, ZF was listed in the E flags register.
Okay.
Other questions? Yes?
So these flags don't like automatically go up when you're comparing two registers, you have to manually put them up with E flags.
The question is, these flags are automatically set when you're comparing two registers. Not only that, they're automatically set when you do almost any arithmetic. So for example, here, I have code which does a subtraction, and then a JLE. And the subtraction is going to have a result of 30. And that means that after that subtraction happens, the subtraction, is, in addition to writing to RBX, is going to set the SF flag to 0 and the ZF flag to 0. Because the result is a positive non-zero number. Yes?
So you're saying before that subtraction instruction, they would be set to 1?
Question is, what would they be set to before the subtraction instruction? We don't have that information.
Okay.
But whatever they were set to before, after the subtraction instruction, are both zero. Other questions? Yes. The question is, is there a manual way to access the condition registers? So you can't access them like you can access REX and so on, but there are instructions to access them, some of which are like annoyingly indirect, like compare and subtract, or jump less than, and there's some, if you want to look them up, more direct instructions, like there's an instruction which is copy the zero flag to AL instruction, if you need that. Other questions? Okay. So here we have an example. We do a subtraction. The result's 30. Therefore, we clear SF and ZF. And we can also get other results. So if I say subtract 20 from 20, I get 0. That's going to set ZF to 1. And SF to 0. If I subtract 0 from negative 10, that's going to set SF to 1. You're going to have a negative result. And ZF to 0. And our corresponding jump less than is going to use that result. Yes? So the question is the last one 10? So remember that in AT&T syntax, you can think of this as subtract from. That it does. Okay. I made an error on this slide. Yes. So I meant to write the other way around. I don't. Good work. So we'll do here. I meant to do 0 RAX. And negative 10 RBX. And I don't. Sorry, yes, you are correct. Thank you for that. I'll try to get that corrected before the next lecture. Other questions? Other things wrong with my slide? Yes. So the question is, why are there two columns here? So GDB displays the values of the registers in two different ways. So for things like REX, it's displaying the register as hexadecimal and decimal. And for the EFLAGS register, this is actually a value you can extract as one number. And it's displaying that one number as hexadecimal, and then it's displaying the decoding of it. That answer your question? Other questions? Yes.
Can you remind me again what EFLAGS is doing in this function?
The question is what EFLAGS is doing here. So EFLAGS is how GDB shows you all the flags together. And it's basically a value you can get from the processor which has all these registers as stuffed into one number. Other questions? Yes.
The most recent slide, can you just explain over the difference between this and like if there are parentheses around registers?
So the question is, how would this differ if I put parentheses around the registers? So in this case, the values are just the numbers I moved in there. If I had parentheses around the registers, I'd be accessing memory. And with the context we have here, well, I don't know what's stored in memory at the location specified, right? So I wouldn't really know what's going to go on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, as I showed you, we got the last arithmetic result. So comp, as I mentioned, so it is, it's like subtraction. The only difference is it just doesn't store the result. It computes the result, it sets the flag registers based on it, but it doesn't actually write it to a normal its normal destination register like it would do if it was actually a subtract instruction. There's a similar instruction you'll often see in assembly that compilers generate called test. So test does a bitwise and most commonly you see it in something like test REX REX. And as we'll discuss when we go over bitwise and later in the semester, probably Thursday or next Tuesday, when we and something with itself, you get itself. So this is setting the condition codes based on the value of REX. So if REX is 0, the 0 flag will be set. If REX is negative, the sign flag will be set, and so on. Yes? Question, does test change the destination? Value in the destination? Test never sets any of the normal registers. Question, does it change the flags? Yeah, it only changes the flags. It's the same idea as compare. It's just instead of subtract, it's a different operation. So the only reason you run a test instruction is to change the flags. That answer your question? So the question is, what does the sign flag mean if you're comparing a bitwise AND? So remember, the flags are based on the result. So the sign flag is the result negative? Yes?
So if you were testing you have two different registers, and one of them had a negative value and one of them had a zero, would that set the zero flag?
So the question is, if I had test and I had two different values as operands, and then one of them was negative and one of them was, you said, zero. The result of that bitwise AND would be zero, as we'll discuss when we go over bitwise AND in more detail. If you don't remember it from some other class, I don't know exactly where we actually teach that. So the zero flag would be set and the sign flag would be clear. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, what's the difference between test and the AND operation? If we did a normal bitwise AND, it would modify the destination register if the result, was different. So in the case of test REX REX and AND REX REX, there's no visible difference because, we'd be overwriting REX with the same value. But if the operands were different, there would be a visible difference. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I said that these condition codes are set by arithmetic. So most arithmetic instructions, including ones that you might not think it's useful to do this with, like multiply, add, divide, set condition codes. There's some instructions, compare and test, that only set condition codes, that don't do anything else. And there's some instructions that don't change condition codes. So LEA doesn't change condition codes. Move doesn't change condition codes. Jump, call, return, etc. don't change condition codes. And for some of these, you might have complaints. You might say, wait a moment, LEA computes something. Isn't that arithmetic? You might say, oh, call does some stack arithmetic. Isn't that computing something? Well, the processor designers made a choice that some of these are things that set condition codes and some aren't. And if you want to figure out which choice they made, you should read their manual if you're in doubt. It's like I've given you, I think, what you'll need to know, but if you want to figure it out, for some tricky case, you have to check the manual because it's a choice they made. They could have arbitrarily decided any number of exceptions if they wanted to. Questions about what sets condition codes? And because we have these instructions that only set condition codes, your much more typical use of condition codes, of course, is with a compare or a test instruction. That we don't actually want to modify the register, don't want to change RBX, but we want to compute, in this case, the value 30 and do our conditional jump based on that, but leave RAX and RBX unchanged. And you might wonder, like, why did they bother making it so normal arithmetic instructions, all these extra instructions that condition codes? Isn't that a lot of extra work? And maybe they shouldn't do that. And, well, some processor designers probably agree with you because not all processors use condition codes. But there's a kind of logic behind this, which comes up when we think of sort of common patterns for loops. That if I have a loop from 99 down to 0, I can kind of just take advantage of my loop arithmetic to set the condition codes for me and not have an extra instruction to do that comparison. And also, when we're building processors, we can add extra hardware that sets the condition codes. And for the most part, that's hardware we need anyways. We need to do those tests of is it zero and so on. And it usually doesn't seem to make a difference if it's running all the time versus only running on certain instructions. So sort of the benefit of condition codes is that in a case like this, we can omit an instruction from a pretty common loop pattern that we otherwise would need to have. So questions about this example? Okay, so since we've seen condition codes, question here, what are the possible values of SF and ZF if there's no overflow? Give you a minute, you can check with your neighbors if you agree. Oh, sorry. Okay. Why? So, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is possible? Who thinks B is possible? Who thinks C is possible? Okay, who thinks D is possible? Okay, so most people think A or B is possible. Some people think C is possible. And most people don't think D is possible. So I'll start with D. D is not possible for the simple reason that a value cannot both be negative and zero. So D is never actually possible combination. And as for looking at what happens here, so if we start with X and RCX, then that moves it into RDX, and then we subtract 1 from that. So this last computation here is x minus 1. Just did. Plus x. And our first question is, can that be 0 for c? So c was the most controversial. Can it be 0? So if we solve this for b equal to 0, and I can rely on this working out this way because there's no overflow. If there's overflow, I have a bunch of other stuff to worry about. I have to worry about, can it be 0 or can it be 2 to the 64? And 2 times 2 to the 64 and so on, but that sort of thing I don't need to worry about. And if we solve this, we're asking, can 2x equal 1? And that would mean x is 1/2. And, well, we can't put a half in an integer register. So c is not possible, assuming no overflow. Now, with overflow, it might be possible. But not overflow, definitely not possible. With overflow, it's probably also not possible. But clearly without overflow, and we do our algebra, it's not a value. There's questions about how I figured this out for C and D not being possible? Now, as for A and B being possible, you can come up with examples fairly easily. So 0, and we start with 0 as x, we end up with negative 1. So that's going to be b. We start with 1 as x, we end with 1, and that's going to be a. So questions? Yes. Sorry? The answer is A and B are both possible. Other questions? Yes. How did I get both A and B? So I eliminated C and D. That makes sense. And then 0, if we run through this, we start with 0 in RCX. Then RDX is negative 1. 0 plus negative 1 is negative 1. Negative 1 has a sine bit of 1. So the sine flag is 1. It's not 0, so the 0 flag is 0. We start with 1. Then we end up with 0 in RDX. 1 plus 0 is 1. That's positive, so the sine flag is 0. It's not 0, so the 0 flag is 0. That gives us A. Other questions? Yes. How do you deal with floats? Floats use different instructions that we will not go over. You can look them up if you need them. It's surprisingly complicated due to x86's history. There's a lot of float instructions. Other questions? Okay. So now that we've seen how condition codes work, we can talk about what I hope is kind of review of translating something like C to assembly. The way I like going about this is I take something like this if-else statement and try to convert it to a bunch of if-go-to, which is our sort of compare or test, then jump some kind of if-something instruction. Or go to, which is going to be a jump instruction, like this. And this is actually, at the bottom is valid C. C has a go to. Don't recommend using it, but it exists. It's actually real C code. So if I'm tasked with translating this to assembly, this is where I'll start. So I'll say, OK, you know, we have if b greater than 42, do something. So I'll say, convert that to if that's not true, skip the something that we would do, and so on. For the else, I have want to skip over the else if we did the if, the then part. So I use a go to do that. So some questions of how I came up, you know, how this pattern works, I should say. So then if I wanted to translate this to assembly, I would then take that sort of expanded C form that this looks more assembly-like, and I can basically go line by line and write assembly instructions. In the case of the if go to, that turns into a compare, then some conditional jump. And otherwise, there's a pretty much a direct line-by-line translation. I might have to look up what the multiply instruction is, but you know, I know there's a multiply instruction I can use. So questions on how I did this? Okay. So hopefully people just kind of remember this. So let's do this exercise. So here's some code. Note that we aren't using a comp, we're using an add, but that shouldn't be an obstacle. What C code is this equivalent to? Okay, so people want more time? Okay. Drink of water. Yes? What question, what's after? It's a label that labels the whatever instruction is after the snippet. Sorry? So the instruction labeled by after is not here. It's just whatever code is next. So people still want more time? A little bit. Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, B, C, D, none of them? Okay, anyone want to defend their answer? Okay.
Is it not equal to?
Yeah. What, not equal to where? In, sorry?
In the if statement, because its jump is equal to after. So
okay.
Not equal to?
Okay. Okay. So that, and so from that you concluded it couldn't be any of them?
Yeah.
Okay. That is correct. So it's almost A, but not quite. Okay, questions? Yeah.
Is that if R3X is not equal to 0 because that's when you just need to
Question, is it if RCX is not equal to 0 because that's what we just put the result of the add into? Yes. So jump equal is going to check for the 0 flag being set. The 0 flag is only going to be set if we just added to get 0, which is only going to be true if RCX was also set to 0. Yes? Sorry? So the correct answer would have been A if we had not equal. It was none of them because, you know, they're all not quite the same. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen translating if statements. We also have to deal with loops. So I'll start with the pattern of the while loop, because that's probably what you write most commonly as loops in C, or for loops, but for loops are easy to translate to while loops. And the way I'd write this is that we have the same idea of we want to kind of invert the condition and skip over the code, and we just repeat that. So rather than at the end of our loop body going to the end of the code, we go back to the beginning and do that comparison again. Some questions on how I made this sort of this like go-to base C translation of the loop? Yes. The question is, could I write a go-to base version that uses the same condition? I believe so. You'd have to reorganize the code a bunch, probably. Other questions? Okay, so then we could translate that into a sort of assembly, just going line by line again. In this case, I put X and R12 because it's a register I don't need to worry about when I call foo. Okay. Now, I've shown you sort of what I think is the most intuitive way to go from this while loop into assembly, but it's not the only option. So let's do this exercise. Which of these are correct translations of the loop? So who would like more time? A few people, okay. Okay, so. So who thinks A is good? No one. Consensus. Or people just haven't figured anything out. Okay, who thinks B is good? Okay, how about C? Okay, so that matches my answer. So the problem with A is that if B starts at, say, 20, we call foo still, even though we're not supposed to. The problem with C is that the comparison is reversed. Like, we could do that, but we could, like, do it if we change the jump greater than or equal to jump less than. Or less than equal, I should say. Right. So this would be, and this is just, you need something to stop the loop from executing the first time for A. Okay. So when you look at what compilers do, they'll often generate maybe not the most intuitive version of the loop, because they're trying to, especially when you tell them to do optimizations. So here are three different versions of the same loop that are all correct, generated by different compilers with different optimization settings. So can someone tell me, why would a compiler generate the second or the third version instead of the first? What would make a compiler do that? Why is that something the compiler wanted to do? Yeah?
It might be a more direct translation of the code it's compiling.
So you think that the second version or the third version is more direct?
It's more closely corresponds to like the C code.
To the C code on top? So I can see the case maybe for the second version. But the third version, that's not a good case. But for the second version, yeah, maybe it's more direct. Yeah. Say it might be more efficient. So is there some case you can make for the second or third version being more efficient?
I'm not sure, but I vaguely heard of something called loop unrolling, so it might be doing something like that.
So you heard of loop unrolling. We'll talk about loop unrolling later in the semester. This is not loop unrolling. But there is something more efficient about, arguably more efficient, I should say, about the second and third loops. Yes. Yeah, so there's less instructions inside the loop, by which we mean the part of the loop that repeats. So clearly, second and third versions have more instructions in the actually assembly code, but the stuff that is actually the loop here has four instructions instead of five. And to eliminate that instruction, the compiler needed to put something at the top. And it moved the conditional jump to the bottom of the loop, and that's the extra instruction we got rid of. And in this version, our loop has actually only three instructions. And the compiler got rid of the comparison by doing a whole bunch of algebra to make the loop counter go down to zero so it could use the zero flag after the decrement that it did algebra to make turn the increment into a decrement. As for, are the second and third versions actually faster? Well, they might be faster if we have enough iterations of the loop. If we don't, they're probably slower. Like, if the loop only executes two times, probably all that setup is not worth it. Okay, so questions? Yes, yes.
So would the second one generally be more efficient
than the third one? If the loop is executing a huge number of times, probably the third one is more efficient. Because we're doing just a decrement instruction instead of an add and compare. So it's probably more efficient if the loop is executing a large enough number of times. Yes?
Can you indent the last move?
Can I what? Could I unindent the last move queue? I could reformat this assembly code, but compilers traditionally do not make it as clear the output of where the loop bodies are, but yes, maybe that would be a better way of formatting this. Other questions? Okay, so talked about translating C to assembly. There's one C construct I want to talk about specially, which is switches. So if I have a switch like this, we do know a way we could turn it into assembly. I could write code like this. Compare A to 1. If it's that, go to the code for 1. Compare A to 2. Go for the code to 2. And this would be valid code for your compiler to generate, but you'd probably be disappointed. You don't like your compiler if you have a switch statement with like 100 cases. Generating this code is probably going to be pretty slow. And you can probably think of ways of doing better. So one way we could do better is we could do a binary search. And sometimes compilers might do this. So in this case, I compare to 50, then compare to 25, and so on. So we could generate that. That's pretty easy to automate. And this is a case where, because we have sort of a higher level construct, the compiler has more options as far as what code it generates. So this binary search is another option. And there's a third option that some compilers do. In fact, most compilers like choose between the various options depending on like what the numbers are and what the optimization setting is. So there's this third option, which is we can have a lookup table. We can have an array of the location of code for 1, code for 2, code for 3, code for 4, and look up the appropriate index in that array and jump there. So here, that's this jump instruction here is looking up in this table based on A, appropriate index, and we have some instructions before to make sure we stay in bounds of that array. And we went over this jump syntax, but to remind you, so this is looking for an address. So let's say we have table located at address 12500 and REX is 2. So we're going to have our table here, and we're going to start at take table minus 8, which is 124F8. And we're going to add 2 times 8, and therefore we're going to get this address here. When we do that arithmetic, and the jump instruction is going to use that as the location of the code we actually want to run. So the code we actually want to run is this code 42 at this 130A0. Questions on this table lookup idea? Yes.
So it's like the table basically like you're indexing the code by its base number, and then once you retrieve the address from the array, that's an address to the code for that case.
Question is, are we indexing the array by the case number? And once we retrieve the value there, that's the code for the case? Yes. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, why am I subtracting 8 from table? The question, order of operations. Am I to do the subtraction first? So the way I would think of it is that this whole thing here, this whole table minus 8, is the displacement. We compute that before we compute anything else. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's our jaunt into assembly. So next time we'll talk about how we go from multiple assembly files into one executable. And then we'll talk about some C issues.